For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
Remember the book of Revelation, the last book in the Bible. Last week we saw that this is written by the Apostle John, the guy whose account of the life of Christ we just finished studying. John is very old at this point. He's probably in his 80s. He's writing from exile in Patmos, an island off the coast of modern-day Turkey. He was sent there because he was a Christian, because he was following Jesus. And this happened near the end of his life in 95 A.D. Jesus shows up with a series of visions to speak directly to John, but also a message that John is supposed to write to these seven different Christian groups that are back just east of John in what's modern-day Turkey. Back then, they called it Asia. And, you know, this church was suffering. They were undergoing tremendous persecution at this point, and so there's elements of comfort here, but they also, as I argued last week, these visions have relevance not just for John and his contemporary audience, but also they go on to tell the future of human history, events that still have not yet taken place. This book is centered around prophecy, predicted prophecy. This is the Jesus that showed up to John, pretty freaky. And this Jesus, as it says, he wants John to write something. He says, I want you to write what you've seen, and that's what we studied last week, this vision of Jesus that he saw. I want you to write what is now. And this is a contemporary message, a message for the churches of John's day. And that's the vision, the first vision in Revelation 2 and 3. And that's what we're going to cover tonight and the next 2 weeks after tonight. And he says, you're also going to write what will take place later. And we'll pick up that thread starting in Revelation 4. And that'll take us all the way through the end of the book. So that's the majority of this book. He says, send this to the seven churches, to Ephesus and Smyrna. We're going to cover those two groups this week. To Pergamum, Thyatira, and Sardis. We're going to cover those three next time. And then the time after next, we're going to cover the final two groups, Philadelphia and Laodicea. And so, you know, these are Christian groups, and Jesus, you know, this Jesus has showed up, and he's got a message for these groups. And these letters to the seven churches, as they're called, that we're going to spend the next three studies talking about, we've got to ask a couple of questions. First of all, what are these about? There's one group that theorizes that what John is really doing here is he's predicting that this is predicted prophecy, and that he's predicting seven historical periods in church history. And it goes basically like this. You know, the first one is the church at Ephesus. That represents the church of the first century A.D. And then the next church is Smyrna. That represents the next couple hundred years of church history. And then Pergamum is the church under Constantine and what sprang out of that, the next three centuries. Then about 800 years are the church of the Dark Ages, the Reformation church, the missionary movement of the 1700s, 1800s, and then the modern church, which has drifted far from God, that would be the church of Laodicea. I don't think this is what he's doing at all. I don't see any indication here that these are future historical periods. These are real churches that John is writing to. He's talking about real contemporary situations. And just, you know, what we read in verse 19, the things you've seen, the things that are, and then the things that are coming after these things. And chapter 4, verse 1 of Revelation, he says, now you're going to write the things that come after these things. And so these are just a contemporary message for the churches of John's day. These are real messages to these ancient groups that were really in existence at the time when John was writing. And these groups, as you can see on this map here, you can see John's writing from Patmos. And these actually existed. There was a road that went, there was roads between these, but there was a circular loop that they could do to drop all of these letters off. And the letters in Revelation 2 and 3, they're in the clockwise order, starting at Ephesus and going around and ending at Laodicea. And so it's not only that these were written to, you know, each of these groups, but each of these cities was also in a strategic place where these letters could be distributed out into the rest of Asia back then. So these are real messages to these ancient groups. But there's also another way of thinking about these is if the shoe fits, then wear it. That each of these churches might have relevance for our modern situation. It wasn't just a message to the Christians living in the city of Ephesus. Because it ends every single one of these letters with this statement right here. He who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. So on the one hand, it's also a message to specific individuals. You see, it says, he who has an ear, let him hear. That's singular. That person, you know, each individual here, if you have an ear, you know, you don't even need two. All you need is one ear to respond to what he's saying here in these letters. And it's also for whole groups. Notice, even though each letter is addressed to a specific Christian group, it says, let them hear what the Spirit says to the churches. So it's written, each of these letters is to all seven of those churches. It's also to the churches that they would distribute this to out in the Turkish countryside. And it's also got relevance for us today. You know, I used to do consulting, where we would show up at different companies and we would sit down with them and they would talk about, you know, I was in IT, and so we would talk about their different networking woes and their, you know, any kind of computer or software engineering solutions they might need. And, you know, we'd kind of take in data and then we'd go back and we'd think about it for a while and we'd come back and we'd present some recommendations to them. And it's pretty helpful to get an outside perspective on your situation. Well, here they get an outside perspective from Jesus Christ himself. I would love if Jesus would show up and give us a message, no matter what he has to say. And that's exactly what we get with these seven churches. All seven of these letters are going to follow the same pattern, too. You're going to notice. It's almost like he's filling out a form letter, you know, like in Microsoft Office where you can kind of pull up templates or whatever. They're all pretty similar. They all start with, and to the angel of the church in blank, fill in city here, write. And it's kind of strange that it's addressed to an angel. You know, it's possible that each of these cities had a head angel assigned to that Christian group. There's some evidence to indicate in the teachings of Christ that people have guardian angels assigned to them. And it's possible that churches also have angels assigned to them. Who knows? Maybe there's a church of Zeno, or an angel of the church at Zenos. And so an angel that's in charge of this, that'd be a very interesting angel, wouldn't it? Wow. Yeah. It could also just be an angelic messenger that's assigned to take this message to each church. It's not clear. I'd probably go a little more with the former interpretation there. And then it says, from... And then there's a description of Christ, and all of these points of the description of Jesus, they're all drawn word for word from Revelation chapter 1, from that vision that John already saw. So the picture of Christ that he painted, this complete picture, Jesus is going to pick out specific components of what John described in Revelation 1 that are going to apply to the situation at each of these churches. Then there's the body of each letter. There's going to be a little thing, what's good about your group. There's going to be a little thing, what's bad about your group, and what you should do about it. Now, not all the churches have both good and bad. Two of them are only good, two of them are only bad, and the other three are mixed. And so, and they're randomized. And so tonight we'll see one that's just, that's one that's mixed and one that's good. And what they should do about it. So Jesus comes in with recommendations for these churches as well. He's not just an armchair critic. You know, some people, they just offer up criticisms without any sort of positive solution. And Jesus is going to come in with some specific action steps to inject a message of hope into these situations, even in the bleakest of cases. No church is too messed up that, you know, they've completely lost it. And then there's a conclusion. And in the conclusion, it always says to the one who overcomes, and he gives a promise to these individual churches, kind of a vision of the future, what they can have if they respond to his challenge. And it also says this, he who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. So it's a call to listen. He's going to make at each point along the way here. And, you know, this is actually something Jesus said sometimes in his ministry as well. And so I guess if you don't want to listen, you don't have to hear. But Jesus is calling on you as a listener here to not just listen, but also to hear and respond to the message that he's got. You know, Jesus doesn't show up and do this too often. And we should treat with a lot of respect when he does do it. So let's take a look at our first church. This is the church at Ephesus, to the angel of the church in Ephesus. Well, we know that church, Ephesus. You know, this is a church we can read about in Acts chapters 18 and 19. You know, it's this city was the third or fourth largest city in the Roman Empire. Up until recently, it was estimated that there was probably 250,000 people here in this city. Now, there's been some, within the last couple of years, some contravening evidence to that. But whatever way you look at it, the Greek geographer Strabo said this was second in importance only to Rome. So this was a major deal. You can see where Ephesus is located. It's right there. Back in ancient times, it was right on the sea, and it had a natural harbor carved out around it. So it was a major center of trade and travel. Here's the view you would have gotten. You know, there's an unbelievable archaeological site at modern-day Ephesus. And when the boat pulled in, this is what you would have seen in the city from the harbor. That's this massive amphitheater. We read about a scene at that amphitheater in Acts chapter 19. You can see here, this is an ancient temple to Domitian. He was the emperor who was in charge at the time of the writing of Revelation. He was the one that initiated this terrible persecution against these Christians. There was actually a temple worshiping this emperor Domitian as a god at Ephesus. Here's the temple to Artemis. It's a drawing from the board game Seven Wonders, which is a great game. It was actually one of the seven wonders of the ancient world. It's 220 by 425 feet. Enormous. And there were at least 14 other deities identified at Ephesus as gods that were worshipped as well. So this was a major center of pagan worship, a major center of false religion. Here's all that's left, though, today of the remains of the temple to Artemis. In fact, there's nothing left at Ephesus except some archaeologists and some tourists. This place was completely deserted from about the 15th century onward. But Ephesus, this was planted by Paul in the mid-50s AD, so the church has been in existence for about 4 years, which is kind of remarkable because Xenos has also been in existence for about 40 years. So this church was about the same age as ours. Very effective at missions. We read in Acts chapter 19 that Paul, after a certain amount of time, he took the Christians with him. He had discussions daily in this lecture hall that they apparently rented out. And this teaching and discipling and this training of leaders went on for 2 years so that all the Jews and Greeks who lived in the province of Asia heard the word of the Lord. So there was a major sending out of Ephesus. Ephesus was probably the church that planted all the rest of these cities, plus many more out beyond that as well. And so there was significant, a ton of success for this church right from the very beginning. In addition to being planted by maybe the greatest church planter ever, their effectiveness at church planting, there were many famous former leaders there. You know, Paul and Timothy were among the two that planted this church originally. We also read that a very famous Christian teacher named Apollos got his start there. We read about that in Acts chapter 18. He went on to have quite a ministry in the early church. Timothy did another round at Ephesus. The books of 1 and 2 Timothy were written to Timothy at Ephesus, with him trying to work through some of the challenging problems that were there at this enormous city that had a sizable church there as well. There were so many people in this church that they had a scroll burning where people burned all their magic paraphernalia. And it was the tune of 50,000 days' wages. That's a lot of money. That's millions of dollars. Also, the Apostle John, according to tradition, did a several decade-long ministry at the Church of Ephesus. So these guys had quite a resume. You know, this was the who's who of Christian leaders. You know, you could maybe argue this was the most important church in the New Testament. You know, it's right up there with maybe a couple of others. We certainly got more information on this than probably any other church in the New Testament, except for maybe the church that was at Jerusalem. So Ephesus, this church, very impressive. And Jesus says, these are the words of him who holds the seven stars in his right hand and walks among the seven golden lampstands. Remember that vision of him? The seven golden lampstands represented the seven churches, each one with a light burning out into the darkness, kind of representative of that church's witness and even existence. And the seven stars were the angels of those seven churches. And so Jesus is right down there in and among with his people, with his church. He says, I know your deeds, your hard work, your perseverance. I know that you cannot tolerate wicked people. that you've tested those who claim to be apostles but are not, and you found them false. So right off the bat, this is looking good. They are a hard-working church. They don't give up. They persevere. They've got plenty of good deeds on their resume. He also says, you guys refute false teachers. You battle false doctrine. You guys are warriors for the truth. And that's good. We need people like that. You know, that was one of the real things you see in the pastoral, in these letters to letters to Timothy, 1st and 2nd Timothy, is his need to fight for the truth, to fight for the truth. It seems like the church really got that message, and they were fighters for the truth. He also says, you persevered. You've endured hardships for my name. You have not grown weary. And so we see the pain and hardship that this church endured as well. This was not a cakewalk. This was not easy. These guys were tough. They were smart. They knew their word. They knew how to refute false teachers. They were not afraid, and they kept on going at it even when things were hard, even when things were painful. And it'd be nice if Jesus ended his letter here, but he doesn't. He said, you guys have so much going for you. I can only think of one thing that you're missing. You've forsaken the love you had at first. This is what he has against them. This is what he's holding against them. The love you had at first. You've forgotten your first love, as it says in other translations. Now, the way this passage is often taught, I've heard this taught before, is as love feelings for God, and, you know, teacher will kind of lay this guilt trip on people that you don't love God enough. And when was the last time that you wept when thinking about the grace of God? And it kind of seems like it's trying to get people to whip up these love feelings for God. That's not what it's talking about. The majority view in commentators is that this is actually referring to lack of love for other people. Lack of love for other people. The love that you had at first. You know, Paul told Timothy in 1 Timothy 1, he says, the goal of our instruction is love. And yet that's the part that this church seems to have left behind. You know, love. Without love, what do we have? 1 Corinthians 13, Paul rebukes the church at Corinth. For they were real into quote-unquote knowledge, and yet they were real into speaking in these powerful other languages, and yet they were lacking love. He says, you know, if I could speak all the languages of earth and of angels but didn't love others, I would only be a noisy gong or a clanging cymbal. That's annoying. That's what that is. You know, that's the effect that you have on people. When you don't love, but you just spout off with, you know, these eloquent words, it's really pretty gross. Hear someone that doesn't love other people and yet wants to just talk and talk and talk about how much they know. If I had the gift of prophecy and I understood all of God's secret plans and possessed all knowledge and had such faith that I could move mountains, you know, I would think that person would be looking pretty good. And yet if they didn't love others, I would be nothing. 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 If I gave everything I have to the poor and even sacrificed my body, I could still boast about it. Yeah, that's true. You could brag and hold yourself over and above people, even in that situation, but didn't love others, I would have gained nothing. Nothing. So without love, I gain nothing. I am nothing. I'm annoying. That's what we are without love. And that's what this church was. This describes this church. He says love, you know, we kind of need a definition of love. Love is patient and kind. Love, not a feeling. I guess there are love feelings. But love is a choice to do everything in my power for the good of this other person. That's why it's patient and kind. It doesn't demand my way. It's not jealous or boastful or proud. It's happy when somebody else succeeds. It's happy when somebody else does better than me. That's what I want. I'm trying to lift other people up. Love's not rude or demand its own way. It's not just what do I want now and I'm going to blast through people to get it. It's not irritable. In fact, it keeps no record of being wrong. Love is easy to please. Hard to hurt and easy to please. Some of us are just the opposite of that. It does not rejoice about injustice, but rejoices whenever the truth wins out. Yes, it's centered on the truth of God. It wants not what I think is best for people, but what God thinks is best for people. Love never gives up, never loses faith, is always hopeful, and endures through every circumstance. This is not the cynical, easily giving up stance that so many of us take. This is a love that hangs in there with people, a love that fights for people, a love that cares, a love that opens up my heart, even if I'm going to be hurt, and continues to go again and again and again to love other people like Christ first loved us. And Jesus says, this is the only thing you're missing. And yet, by losing out on this, this is the most important thing. This is the greatest commandment is love. Love one another. So this actually refers to lack of love for others. And yet, this lack of love for others that Jesus is addressing through John here cannot be separated from our love for God. Somebody asked Jesus once, what's the greatest commandment? And Jesus was like, well, you should love God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. But the second commandment is just like it. You should love your neighbor as yourself. Jesus put, you know, he couldn't even give one answer when somebody asked him for the greatest commandment. He gave two because the second is just like it. Loving God and loving other people. 1 John, in John's epistle, here's what John says. He says, anyone who does not love God, does not know God, for God is love. Those two are intertwined with one another. If you're not loving people, there's something wrong in your relationship with God. Again, he says we love each other because he loved us first. It's the love I receive from God overflows in other people. So that's why he can say, if I'm not loving other people, there's something wrong between me and God. And so this does indicate a breakdown in their individual relationships with God too. Not the fact that they don't have enough love feelings. Probably the fact that they're not even spending time with God. That has gone by the wayside. That there's some sort of a breakdown there. There's some sort of alienation on our part there. I kind of like how NLT takes it. They say, you don't love me or each other as you did at first. And so that's kind of like I guess they couldn't decide which one it was. They just picked both of them. But, you know, let's think about this. Let's think about this. I want to do a little bit of discussion in the middle of the teaching here. I want you to imagine a loveless relationship. It can be any kind of relationship. Now, what would a relationship like that look like? What do you guys think? How would you describe that relationship? Yeah. Tense? Okay, cool. Tense. Yeah. Tense, yeah, and closed off. So there's like a hostility or a lack of warmth there. Yeah. Work? In what way? Yeah, in healthy love relationships, we actually are built up as we give out to these other people. And yet, if we're just kind of tolerating people or putting up with people, it's really draining. It's hard work to stick in there. Yeah. Okay, apathetic. I'm not really, definitely not going the extra mile for this person. Definitely not thinking about them when they're not around. Yeah. Self-centered. Yeah, I'm really thinking about me. I'm thinking about how I can take from this other person. Good. Yeah. Yeah, it's two people using each other, two people trying to get what I can out of this whole thing, not seeking to give to another person, just taking. Okay, so here's another question. What might cause a relationship to degenerate into this state? How do you go from where they were or where you were, where you had healthy love for another, and then it degenerates to what he's talking about here in this passage? Yeah. Yeah, taking the person for granted, lack of gratitude would be mixed in there with that. Did you want to? Yeah, sometimes we get insecure, and so we close off. We don't want to take risks in our relationships, and it's a lot safer just to hang back passively and protect ourselves from people. Good. Yeah. Yeah, selfishness, taking. You know, that's a sure way to get everybody closed off from one another. This is no longer a place where I'm excited to give, but this is a place where it's not safe. I got to protect myself. Yeah. Oh yeah, I will run people over if they're blocking me from my goal. I might tolerate people, and yet if they come between me and something I really want, then I will quickly cast them to the side. Yeah. Unwillingness to change or really put forth any, lack of effort, lack of willingness to change. There's a lot of factors that can get us here. But what I'd like to talk about is what to do about it. And what Jesus tells them is this. He says, the first thing you've got to do is you've got to consider how far you've fallen. You know, these loveless relationships, a lot of times it's hard to even detect that I'm in one of these. It's difficult. And he says, you need to think about how far you've fallen. And so what that means is you've got to think about where you were before, and then what am I doing now? He goes on to say, do the deeds that you did at first. And so it's specifically, he's focusing in on not these inner, murky inner motives, but the actions that we're taking. And so what were you doing before compared to what you're doing now? Here's what Palmer and Ogilvie say in the Preacher's Commentary. They say the Ephesus problem happens quietly and by gradual, imperceptible shifts of focus. What happens is that a man or woman is first united with the Christian church because of having discovered and believed in Jesus Christ and his love. And there's a period of excitement. After a few years of being a Christian, that person may become a leader in the church with very heavy responsibilities. But something happens along the way. That person, who because of giftedness and hard work, may now stand at the vortex of church politics and decision making, and they experience a subtle shift in style of life. That person finds himself or herself motivated and nourished by the organization, or by the controversy, or by ambition to hold power. The first love has been replaced, while perhaps no one was aware of the replacement. The first love has been abandoned, and in its place is the starchy, high cholesterol diet of activity and church work that will never nourish the human soul. It's part of why we need love, is for the nourishment that we get from it as we give out to other people. The irony of this latter condition of the Ephesus syndrome is that the Christian becomes totally preoccupied, fascinated by themes and goals which would have never have won him or her to Christ in the first place. Arguments over fine doctrinal points, distinctives of leadership, polity, esoteric giftedness, etc. How can it happen to us? It happens to marriages. It happens to human friendships. It happens also to the life of discipleship. This is a very real danger, the Ephesus problem. A church with great, you know, resume, a decorated history of awesome, powerful leaders over the few decades of its existence, 40 years or so, slowly slips away and becomes more mechanical and ends up as just a monument to something that once was a museum to greater days gone by. So Jesus says, consider how far you've fallen. You know, another way of thinking about it is I used to blank, but now I blank. All right. So we can think about it in those terms. You know, in your love for others, you know, think about that when you first moved into that house with those other Christians, maybe a year or two ago. You know, when you first moved in, full of zeal and excitement, initiation. I remember when I first moved in with a house with other dudes, I was just so thrilled to be in a place where I could actually build relationships, a place that was safe. I was so thrilled to actually have friends that I was like, I am going to be open. I'm going to initiate with people. I'm going to make the most of every single day I've got living with these other believers. I'm going to be talking about what I'm reading in God's word. I'm going to initiate prayer. I'm going to share about my life. I'm going to get into other people's lives. And then, you know, as the months go by, there's just a very imperceptible change, you know, a degree per day or something. And yet, as time goes on, I find myself lacking that initial zeal, that initial commitment to love other people. Things really slip, and maybe some of you find yourself in that position. To think back, to remember how far you've fallen. And maybe you haven't fallen that far. Maybe you haven't fallen at all. I hope for all of us we can say that each year of my Christian life, I'm growing more and more to be like Christ. That we're always growing Christians. But some of us, maybe we're starting to slip. Some of us maybe have stalled out. This is something to really consider. What did you do at first? How late I used to stay up hanging out with people. How much enjoyment I used to get from my relationships. And I don't know if that's really the case anymore. Or what about the previous group you were in? You know, we had a good run there. we really bonded, we experienced God's power moving, and then maybe we planted a new group, and we went off from some of our friends, perhaps. And we find ourselves looking back over our shoulder and wishing we were over there. We find ourselves having the good old days syndrome, thinking back on the way things once were. This has happened to me as well. I remember this one time we planted our home church, and I got about 6 months into it, and I just realized, I do not want to go to home church. And the reason I had to admit was because I love the people that we were with, and I still miss them, and I'm kind of resenting my current people for not being like them. And Jesus says, no. You've forgotten your first love, the love that you once had. What about telling other people about Jesus? We were so eager to do that as new believers. And yet, where has that gone? What happened to that? So exciting. Now we're just terrified by even the thought of it. Heard a story recently about a girl who had been a good Christian leader, went into a several-year funk, and then started sharing with her friend about Jesus. Her friend came to Christ, and it was really enough to completely snap her out of the funk that she was in. She's doing great now. Encouraging other people. Maybe that used to be a regular element of your relationships, and you can't even remember the last time you encouraged someone or expressed any appreciation, any gratitude for them. Jesus says, consider how far you have fallen. Or what about your relationship with God? You know, you got busy with life or ministry. You never got reengaged, spending daily time with Him, time in His Word, time in prayer. You decided just to get in the Word because you don't really like prayer that much, or vice versa. What about this one? Sometimes this is especially a danger during life transitions. You know, I remember when I made the transition from single to married, it's like I just never quite got my time with God back on track after that. And it took me a year and a half before I really got any sense of consistency again. But I just kind of lost my way. I just thought, well, I'm preparing for a Bible teaching or something like that. That's good enough, right? Or I know a lot of Bible already, so I don't really need to read it anymore. If we find ourselves saying those sorts of things, that's a problem. We've forgotten our first love. We're not even showing up to receive the love of God so that we can give out in love for other people. Jesus says, consider how far you've fallen and repent and do the things you did at first. Repent just means it means a change of mind, change of direction. Go back. Do those other things. You know, and this is not the good old days syndrome. You know, good old days syndrome looks back at the past and actually feels despair, feels sad, just makes me resent my current circumstances even more, just makes me feel more depressed and more hopeless. No, this is a hopeful, it's reflecting on the past, not trying to recreate it, but to do the things that are within your control are to do the things you did at first. To learn from the past and to gain insight on the present situation. Jesus says, if you don't repent, I'll come to you and remove your lampstand from its place. That's how serious this is. He says, if you're not going to love, then I will take my lampstand back. Thank you very much. I'll go somewhere else. Some people that want to love. You know, the last thing I want to be associated with is a church that doesn't love, considering that was the summation of the entire law and all the prophets and the new command that I gave you. You can't just make up for that with other things by your doctrinal knowledge or how good you fight false teachers, how hard you work. We must have love. Love. You have this in your favor. You hate the practices of the Nicolaitans, which I also hate. That's a group of false teachers. We'll just talk about them next week if they come up again. And he concludes. He says, whoever has ears, let them hear what the Spirit says to the churches. To the one who is victorious, I will give the right to eat from the tree of life, which is in the paradise of God. That's just basically the teaching that, you know, the tree of life was there before we sinned against God. And as we're going to read at the end of this book, there's one in heaven as well. And it's the right to be there. It kind of sounds like you have to do X, Y, and Z in order to get to heaven. This is really just consistent with the New Testament teaching that real believers will overcome. They will endure. They will persevere. And he says, whoever has ears, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. Not whoever has ears. You should use this passage to tell other people how much they suck. to criticize the other people in your home church about how they're not loving you the right way. No, that's not what it says. It says you need to listen. You need to repent. You need to do the deeds you did at first, or maybe to do them for the first time if you've never done them before. To get out there and love people fervently from the heart, as Peter says. That's the message to Ephesus. We got one more church to go. It's shorter. He says, to the angel of the church in Smyrna, right? In fact, that word Smyrna is the same word for myrrh, like that funeral spice. And so this city was kind of associated with death. It's literally the same word as myrrh. This was a harbor city. It was a major commercial hub. Here you can see it's just up the coast from Ephesus. It's also got its own little harbor there. It was also famous for its persecution. There's an account from 150 AD of a guy named Polycarp who was discipled by John. As a young man, Polycarp was discipled by John, and Polycarp's in his 80s when he's killed for his faith in Smyrna. And part of the reason for all the persecution at Smyrna is because this city was especially loyal to Rome. It was a center of worship of the emperor. You know, in 195 BC, they were the first city to build a temple to the goddess Roma, which represented the city of Rome and really the state of Rome. And so they were like early adopters on worshiping Rome. Also, in 26 AD, they were chosen over 11 other cities to be the second site for an imperial cult temple. That's a temple where they worship the emperor. And so, you know, in Smyrna, you could be persecuted. When everybody else stands up and says, Caesar is Lord, what's the Christian going to do? Certainly not say that. I only worship Jesus. That's why they call the Christians atheists, because they only worship one God. They wouldn't worship all the other gods of Rome. And so they could be excluded from the guilds. It was basically the fast track to unemployment. You couldn't participate in the economic life of the city. It was devastating. Imagine becoming a Christian and then realizing, if I'm going to be loyal to Christ, I think I'm going to have to not worship the emperor anymore, which could mean my job, which could mean I can't get a job. And what are the implications for my family? Heavy persecution here at Smyrna. You know, here we've got the ancient agora, that's kind of the marketplace area, and then this hill up there, that's Mount Pegasus, the ancient Acropolis, which was the high point. This is where they put a lot of their temples to these different gods and goddesses. And in fact, we've got ancient sources that it was such a stunning sight, the Acropolis on top of Mount Pegasus, that it was called the Crown of Smyrna, the Crown of Smyrna. And so this is a well-known ancient city, very influential. Jesus says, these are the words of him who is the first and the last. And you know, when you're suffering, it's good to know that Jesus, he was the first one here. After all this passes away, he's still going to be here. He is the only eternal thing, in contrast to the temporary suffering in my life. He's also the one that died and came to life again. And in a case where some were being executed for their faith, that's also really good to know. And as he went on to say in chapter 1, I hold the keys to death and Hades. And so he has the power to release people from death. In fact, the word death comes up in 3 of the 4 verses addressed to Smyrna here. Something that was heavy on their minds. Jesus says, I know your afflictions and your poverty, but you're rich. He doesn't have anything bad to say about Smyrna. He's like, I know that you guys are poor. I know that you've been excluded from the life of the city in large part. I know this is a wealthy city and you guys are feeling pretty stupid, feeling like the lowest of the low, but he says, I know, I see your true wealth. You guys are rich, rich in heavenly treasures. And that's really the only treasure that's going to matter when it's all said and done, because Jesus is the first and the last at the end. He says, I know about the slander of those who say they are Jews and are not, but are a synagogue of Satan. Sounds like John's being anti-Semitic here. Which he wasn't. I mean, John was Semitic. He was a Jew. So he's pro-Semitic. So is Jesus. Jesus was not anti-Semitic. He was Semitic. His point is, you know, the Jews were in this city, they were actually exempt from having to worship the emperor. But they did join in with the rest of the city in heaping persecution on the Christians there. And so he's like, they're really not true Jews. These guys are being used by God's enemy, Satan. That's who's behind this suffering and this persecution. He says, do not be afraid of what you're about to suffer. And so Jesus foresees a trial coming upon this church. Even though they had already suffered, he's warning them that more suffering is going to come. He says, I tell you, the devil will put some of you in prison to test you, and you will suffer persecution for 10 days. Is that literally 10 days? Is that like, you know, 10 days is also used elsewhere in Scripture to represent like a short period of time. I don't know. I don't think it really matters that much. It is true that this is language from the gladiatorial games, which was a time often of intense fear for the Christians that they might be seized and thrown in with these games to be killed by gladiators or wild animals. But I think it probably is just referring to a short period of time, maybe 10 days, maybe longer than that. But Jesus is warning them, you're going to suffer, but it's not going to last that long. So hang in there, hang in there. Be faithful, even to the point of death, and I will give you the crown of life. He says, you think the crown of Smyrna is cool? Wait till you get the crown of life given to all who are in heaven. This is the victor's crown that they would give out at the Olympic Games. You need to be faithful, even if it means you're going to die. You can't shrink back in the face of death if you're going to follow Christ, especially in times of suffering. What do we learn from Smyrna then? One is that suffering is real. As easy it is to feel like, you know, we're pretty insulated from suffering in our culture, you're not going to be thrown in prison for being a Christian. This suffering was very real for them. Imagine being beaten and just being crippled for the rest of your life. Chronic pain or even unable to walk. You know, that could happen, beaten with rods or flogged. And imagine the infections that could result from being flogged, some that might even lead to death. And the impoverishment, to have everything taken away, to realize this could happen at any moment. And, you know, you can imagine the what-if scenarios that start to play out under anxiety. You're thinking, what if this happens? What if that happens? What about my family? You start to think, the pressure begins to weigh in on you. Am I going to give in here or not? And ultimately, some of them were going to be killed. And they had to be willing to do that as well. And, you know, with suffering, if you're not suffering now, you're going to suffer at some point. Suffering is going to get real in your life at some point. Paul tells Timothy, all who want to live a godly life in Christ Jesus will be persecuted. And so that's just something that you should at least arm your mind to suffer, as Peter tells his readers. Suffering is short. Suffering is short. Jesus tells them it's only going to be 10 days, but really, from the perspective of eternity, any suffering that we experience here and now is going to be short compared to what lies beyond this life. As Paul says in 2 Corinthians 4, he calls it momentary light affliction. And he says it's producing for us an eternal weight of glory far beyond all comparison. There's no comparison here. Momentary light affliction on this side of the scale, eternal weight of glory on that side of the scale. And that's how it's going to feel. You know, it's not going to be too long before you're going to be standing before Christ. Your life is going to be over. Life goes real fast. And you're not going to ever have a chance to suffer for him again. This is our only chance to suffer in this life. Not that we seek it out or bring it upon ourselves foolishly, but that we're willing to do it. We're willing to hang in there and stand fire and remain faithful, even maybe even to the point of death. Who knows where things are going to head for us or for your life. And, suffering's kind of that way. You know, I run sometimes, and there's a lot of times when I'm running where I'm in so much pain, and all I can think about is the pain that I'm in. And I just want to stop, you know, and I'm like, you know, I could stop right now. Nobody would know. I can just call it like a cool down walk here or something, you know, the final mile. Whenever I stop, though, I always regret it. I'm like, I really can't even remember what the pain felt like. I kind of wish I would have kept going. I kind of wonder if some of us might feel that way, if we take the shortcut, if we anesthetize ourselves to pain versus really standing fire and standing up to it. And so if you are suffering, hang in there. Hang in there. It's not going to be very much longer before it's all going to be over with. Finally, Jesus is in control. Jesus is in control. You know, sometimes I like to think about worst case scenario. And, you know, if you think about for these Smyrna Christians, What's the worst case scenario? I mean, they die, and then they stand, they're right before Jesus a few moments later. They depart. Paul says that's very much better to depart and go be with Christ. And even in our lives, I mean, worst case scenario, we know Christ will never leave us nor forsake us if we're his, if we're Christians. And we know that even in the face of death, we know that we'll go to be with him. We also know that he knows the exact day of each of our deaths. He doesn't allow anything into our lives, nothing that's outside of his control. It's not that he causes everything, but he allows things into our lives. We live in a fallen world, a world that's stained by evil and suffering. And yet he promises to use it all for good. All for good. He works all things for good for those who love him and are called according to his purpose. A few real encouraging pieces of advice I got lately from an interview with a guy named Chuck Smith I listened to that he gave right before his death. He was a godly man that had served God his whole life into his 80s. And he was sharing about a time in his life when his brother and his dad were killed suddenly and tragically in a plane crash. And the thing that he said that I don't know if I'll ever forget, he says, you know, in times of suffering and even in facing death, he says, don't trade what you do know about God for what you don't know. Don't trade what you do know for what you don't know. And that's what we're tempted to do in times of suffering. Is, you know, we don't know why this is happening, and we get so angry at God, we get so bitter at him, and we're bitter about things that we have no knowledge of. We have no idea what's happening here. We don't see things from his perspective. And that's why in the face of suffering, we've got to cling to what we do know. The promises of God, the faithfulness of God, God's track record in my life. That's what we've got to cling to. And we've got to reaffirm these beliefs over and over again. As the suffering comes, as the anxiety comes, as the fear comes in, we've got to go back to that. And not trade what we do know for what we don't know. The other thing that he said in that interview is he said, God doesn't comfort us so we can be comfortable, but so we can be comforters. And that's so true. Part of what I've noticed with the suffering that I've had to go through is how God used it in my life, and also how God has used that to enable me to comfort other people. To realize it's not all about me. To realize this is a world of suffering and pain with hurting people. And there's certain things that you're just not going to be able to speak to unless you've gone through it. And there's a certain character, type of person God is trying to form in you that you just can't get there any way other than through suffering and responding well to that suffering. Sure, you can get bitter in the face of suffering, but responding rightly to suffering produces sweet, broken Christians, so loving, so much like Christ. And that's why Jesus says in Revelation 2:11, whoever has ears, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. The one who is victorious will not be hurt at all by the second death. A lot of people don't know this, but you know, everybody dies once, but non-Christians die twice. That when Jesus returns, everyone is resurrected. And then those that are in a relationship with Christ that have been forgiven by him, they go on into eternal life. But those who don't, those who've decided that I'm going to try to stand before God and argue based on my own righteousness, my own good works, it says they will be cast into hell with their body for eternity. And that's once and for all. And but what he says is, if you're mine, you won't be hurt by that second death. And so even though some of you are dying, know that that's the last death you're ever going to experience. And that's encouraging, I guess, in the face of death. In conclusion then, you've got to ask yourself this question. Do you have ears to hear? Seriously, don't just quickly say yes to that, but in your heart, are you willing to listen to what God has to say to you, to what God is already saying to you? For many of us here, God is already trying to tell you something, and you've been resisting him. You haven't been listening. You've been holding out, kind of pretending like you're confused, but in reality, it's your prayer needs to not be, God, what's your will here, but God, not my will, but yours be done. Do you have ears to hear? And if you do, and you're not a Christian, your first step is to receive the forgiveness that Christ offers. He says, I will grant to you to be able to eat from the tree of life in paradise. He says, the second death will have no power over you. I'm the one who's conquered death, and I will not allow you to be harmed. You ever wonder where you're going to go when you die? Jesus Christ says, I'm the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father but through me. So if you're not a Christian, you need to receive Christ, receive his forgiveness, invite him into your heart. But if you are a Christian, then there's really two lessons here. One is the lesson of Ephesus, that it's surprising how quickly good groups can falter. It's surprising how quickly and imperceptibly individuals can lose it as well. But you know what's even more surprising? To see the hope that Christ holds forth, to see how eager he is to take them back, to see, in spite of their blatant violation of the greatest commandment, he says, look, there's still time here. There's still hope. And for you, if you've wandered away from love, there's still time. If you can even hear, there's still time. You can turn back. It's not too late to love fervently, to go back to what you were doing at first, or to start doing it for the first time ever. And maybe some of us need to hear the words that he speaks to Smyrna. Some of us are suffering. We're suffering. It's painful to consider the fact that it's not going to last that long. Even if it lasts the rest of our lives, it's not that long in comparison with eternity. To know that Christ is with us through all of that, and to know that he is the one who has died and is now alive. To know that he is sovereign and that all eternity will end up at his feet, that he is in control no matter what happens to us in this life. You know, Polycarp, John's disciple, when he was executed in the arena at Smyrna, and they brought him up before the crowds, the council, they called on him to acknowledge Caesar as Lord. They called on him to reject atheism, which was their word for Christianity. And I'm sure that the words of his disciple or John were still ringing in his head 60 years later when he steps forward. And here's what he says at the end of his life. He says, for 86 years I've been his servant, and he has done me no wrong. How can I blaspheme my king who saved me? And I pray that we can all stand firm like that in the face of suffering. Amen.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.